Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
You got arrested by Milwaukee PD.
I did.
That was a bad night, man. So I get an informant who again tells me he's got a couple guys that can do ounces and I can follow that with kilos. What I don't know is a couple weeks before, these two guys had driven by and pumped a bunch of bullets through a second floor beauty salon. My informant cuts me into them. I jump in their car. We park in a dead end. And negotiations are going really good. Next thing I know is five Milwaukee squads in a paddy wagon come screaming down the dead end. Guns out. Get your hands in the air. So I get out of the car, put my hands in the air. The only thing I have on me is I got that old 38 again stuck in a back.
In your butt crack.
In my butt crack. Okay, thank you. And they both, of course, they both have guns. So I hear the cops as they're searching independently call out, gun, gun, gun. And then the cuffs go on and in the paddy wagon, they take us.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to part two of episode 180 of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Still here with Bill Hare, former and now retired BNDD and DEA agent. If you met with us yesterday, you heard about his career in the very beginning. This is before DEA was even created. That's where I want to start today is, Bill, so you came on with the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, but then, what, a year later is when the President of the United States said, hey, I'm creating a new agency, right?
Yeah, almost exactly a year later.
So what was the focus? Why did it change from one to the other? And
well,
why?
Yeah, a couple of things happened during, say, a 3 or 4 year time period between 1970 and 1974-ish. The first substantial thing that happened before I even came on the job was Congress passed the Controlled Substances Act in 1970, which gave narcotic investigators great new tools to go after the bad guys, one of which was the conspiracy law. And at the same time, Nixon declared that there was a war on drugs and that drugs were, heroin was really big in New York, Nicky Barnes and that crew. Nixon created what he called the Drug Enforcement Administration, which was a merger of the DEA agents we had at that time, which I thought was only like 800 and 1400 customs agents. And they would merge up together. The customs agents jumped into the DEA groups and the what were BNDD groups. And we had there was a 6 month learning curve because the customs guys had done a different job than we were doing. And we wanted to continue doing the job that we were doing, going UC, doing surveillance, doing stuff like that. And it finally worked out. After about 6 months and you peeled all the layers away, we found out that the customs guys had the same motivations and same goals that we had. So we got together and doubled, if not tripled, the size of the agency and had a lot more manpower and started using the 846, the conspiracy law, and some of the other tools that they gave us. The amazing thing, and part of the reason for the book, is it shifted midway through because I started thinking, God, during the time I was on the job, we got all these new tools that nobody had before, and nothing's changed. You know, you use the conspiracy laws, and you locked up group after group after group of people, and, well, you see what's going on today. So
I get interviewed on some TV shows occasionally and podcasts and radio shows, things like that. Javier and I both do. And people always ask, you guys took down Pablo Escobar. Did you have any effect, any positive effect on cocaine trafficking by taking down the Medellin cartel? We tell them, yeah, we did. Lasted about 2 weeks. Because Cali cartel stepped up. And here's the sad truth. here we are in 2025 now, and I asked the question, can you go out on almost any street corner in the United States and buy cocaine today? And the answer is yes, you can.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so many people that want to make that what they think is easy money, but the problem I have with it is the demand, because if we could drop the demand in the United States, the supply would go away.
That's that's stuck into my head is as long as we have this voracious demand, which was created when cocaine first started hitting the United States, say that in the late 70s, early 80s. And I mean, a kilo would come up and that thing would be sold in a matter of hours. Then two kilos would come up in a matter of hours, and then 20, and then 100, and then 1,000. And as fast as they could get it up here, it would be on the streets.
It's amazing. That's a whole nother topic to talk about. We want to get back to Bill's career here. So if you remember from yesterday's episode, he moved over to Milwaukee. And so you're 28 years of working for the government, right?
Yeah.
And 23 of those years were spent working undercover. I did a total of 26 with DEA. And my last undercover was right before I became a GS. And I'd probably been on the job 9 years, I think, at the time. Why did you want to do undercover for 23 years? That's a long time.
Well, I don't know if I wanted to or if the demand was there to do it, because, and when I say 23 years working undercover, it wasn't like 23 years in a row, because I had a lot of conspiracy cases in the middle of them and stuff like that. But anytime a stool came in the office and said, I can introduce you to a guy and you can get a couple OZs of coke, but he's got kilos behind him. Yeah, I couldn't walk away from it. I'd say, I'd check it out. And if it looked right, I said, throw the call in and let's see what we could do.
And did you get a little excited when those would come? I mean, did you feel that little thing in your stomach?
Oh, like, for sure.
This is good.
Yeah. Yeah. Adrenaline is a wonderful thing.
Oh, yeah. You know, even now, people say, don't I miss it, because I've been retired since 2013. I don't miss the BS bureaucracy, the personnel issues and all that kind of stuff. But when I talk to agents now or even cops at the gym, I've gotten to know quite a few local cops here at the gym I go to in the mornings, and they'll start talking about cases. All of a sudden, they've got my attention. I'm forgetting about working out or whatever else is going on. And I start hitting with questions. Have you done this? Have you done that? Have you done that? Could you possibly do this? Have you tried a wiretap? Are you doing, are you pulling toll records? Have you done trash runs? Have you gotten a foreman? What have you vetted the foreman? And they're looking at me like, oh, man, would you shut the hell up? Yes, we're doing it.
Sounds like me.
But
same thing.
That old fire comes back, doesn't it?
Yeah. When I was writing the book, there were a couple incidents where I – close call incidents with shoot or don't shoot. And I had some tax squad buddies of mine that read the book before I even thought about making a book. I was just writing stuff to see, because both my hands got screwed up. So I was just writing stuff. And there were a couple incidents where one particular one, I'm running up a narrow attic stairs. It's fairly dark. The tax squad was busting a bunch of guys in the lower. Everybody's rolling around and kicking and saying words that you're very familiar with and I'm very familiar with. But I get to the top of the stairs, to the peak of the stairs, and I look, and there's a guy laying in bed, and he's got a great big old silver hog leg, I call it. And, it was like a 6-inch 44 Magnum or something like that. And I screamed something at him. And he's starting now to wake up and hear all the scuffling going on downstairs. And he doesn't quite know, drop the gun, drop the gun. Well, I said it three times before he leaned over, and I should have shot him, but he leaned over and set the gun on the floor of the bed. And then I grabbed him and hooked him up. But when I described that story in the book, the tax squad officers said our adrenaline was pumping when we were reading that, because we remember that. And I got to tell you, the tax squad sergeant who was in charge of the warrant, it was my warrant, but it was a tax squad sergeant who was in charge of executing. We get done with that, and I'm feeling pretty damn proud of myself, because they didn't know about the attic. The informant didn't tell them about the attic. I saw the door. I opened it. I saw it went up. I said, okay, I'm going to take a peek. And I got a guy with a gun. That's pretty damn good. So I'm outside talking to Copper, they call him 702, San Filippo. And I'm saying, yeah, man, I'm so happy I got that guy and stuff like that. And San Filippo looks at me with kind of this look. And all of a sudden, the sergeant comes down. He's about 6'4". Looks like he's an Army veteran, but looked like an Army drill sergeant. He comes down, and he got into me so bad. I mean, he just drilled me. And he got done with me, and he said, I don't know if I'll ever work with you again. And he turned around and went back into the house to his guys. And I looked over at San Filippo, and he said, Jerry, I says, what'd I do? He said, you hollered, drop the gun one too many times. That makes perfect sense to me.
As you were telling that story, I'm smiling because I remember reading that. These were the Milwaukee TAC 700s is what they were referred to.
The 700s,
right?
Greatest group of guys.
That's the kind of guys you want to work with.
Yeah, I went through. Well, I'll tell you what. I got together with them like just a couple of weeks ago. We get together every, three or four months. But I got together with San Filippo, and he brought some pictures, and he brought a picture of the guys I was getting together with taken at the completion of their set of their 1,000th search warrant. That's all they did. High risk entries. And can you imagine 1,000 search warrants?
Wow. That's a lot. That's a lot of doors to kick in.
Yeah.
Well, so now in your book I read about, and I was kind of surprised when I read this. I understand it.
Uh-oh.
You got arrested by Milwaukee PD, didn't you?
I did.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a bad night, man. So I get an informant who, again, tells me, good informant, tells me he's got a couple guys that can do ounces, and I can follow that with kilos. So as long as I heard kilos on the end, I'd go out. If it was just ounces, thanks, I'd take a pass. So anyhow, we run them through Milwaukee Vice, and they don't have anything on these two guys. What I don't know is a couple weeks before, on a Friday night, these two guys had driven by and pumped a bunch of bullets through a second floor beauty salon right downtown, right, actually kitty corner of the federal building. The beauty salon was a front for one of the main organized crime guys in Milwaukee. So the two guys pump holes into it, but they're also selling dope. My informant cuts me into them. I jump in their car. I'm negotiating with them. We're talking. They're lighting up a joint. Asking me if I want to smoke. I say, for whatever reason. By now, my skills are honed enough where I don't have any problem telling them, you want to get stupid while we're doing a dope deal, go ahead, but I'm not in that game. So we were right on a major thoroughfare. They said, can we move the car and go park where it's a little more private? I said, sure. So we park on a dead end, and negotiations are going really good. I'm very confident that we're going to be able to do something with these guys. And I knew my surveillance team was out there. Next thing I know is five Milwaukee squads in a paddy wagon come screaming down the dead end, guns out, get your hands in the air, MFs, get you this and that, you scumbags. This is how they must feel when we stick them up. So I get out of the car, put my hands in the air. The only thing I have on me is I got that old 38 again stuck in a back.
In your butt crack.
In my butt crack. Okay, thank you.
There you go.
And, of course, they both have got guns. So I hear the cops as they're searching independently call out, gun, gun, gun. And then the cuffs go on, and in the paddy wagon, they take us. Well, I'm whispering to the guy who's leading me. I'm saying, he says something to the effect of, and I'm Mickey Mouse dumbbell, get in the paddy wagon. So I get in the paddy wagon with these two guys, and all three of us, I mean, they're as surprised as I am, and there's no heat on me whatsoever. They're still thinking I'm a bad guy. And so they take us downtown, and they put us in the bullpen. Bullpen was a 20 by 40 foot concrete floor thing full of crooks that are waiting to go get processed. And now my concerns are being raised because somebody in there might know me because I've been doing enough work in the city, and I'm saying, just get me out of this freaking bullpen. Well, fortunately, they come back, grab me, print me, photograph me, and when they printed me and photographed me, I keep on telling them, I'm DEA, I'm DEA. I get the same response. You know, yeah, I'm Mickey Mouse. You're going to jail, son. So they threw me in a cell, and that was at 10 o'clock at night. I'm in the cell till 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, my surveillance team had gotten together with the Dicks, and they figured out what was going on and why the detective squad came and got in the middle of our deal. The detectives didn't communicate with narcotics, so nobody knew what was going on. So they all went to a bar, and they formulated a plan to get me out of jail, which was for my boss to contact the night shift commander and say he really is a DEA agent. Let him go. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, they come and get me. And I asked the cop who opened the cell, I said, could you just do me a favor and drive me out to 60th and Hawley so I could have a drink with the guys? And sure enough, 3 o'clock in the morning, these bums are still sitting in the bar drinking, waiting for me to show up.
What took 5 hours to get you out of there?
Good drinks at the bar, I suspect.
Or too many drinks.
I never got a good answer to that, but I was plenty happy to have gotten out of the bullpen unscathed.
Oh, man, that was hilarious when I was reading that in your book. Those are the stories that just, it's serious, but in the end, it's good for a laugh.
Serious as a heart attack.
One of the things I read about in there is, and this doesn't happen very often. I've had a couple other guests here on the show who have been considered expert witnesses. And you were recognized as an expert witness, right?
Yeah.
And so for our listeners, just explain what the significance of that is, because that's not a common thing.
No, in drug cases, in fact, I think I was probably one of the first 10 DEA agents to hit a witness stand. And the difference between an expert witness in any type of case, be it a medical fraud case or a drug case, is the difference is, and it, once you're qualified as an expert, you can give an opinion. Okay, you can't give an opinion as a regular transactional witness.
Right. You can only answer questions.
Right. So where I did most of the expert testifying was like when ATF or IRS or DEA in the early years, or even me in one of my cases, we'd hit a house and there'd be, this is a basic example, but there'd be 50 little cut corners off of plastic bags that have a white powdery residue in them. And there'd be a triple beam scale and there'd be other stuff laying around.
Right.
The juries at that time, they didn't know what that stuff was. So I'd explain it to them. And as the expert witness thing progressed, it got to the point where there was one case where I think it was a Florida agent came up. But anyhow, they grabbed a kilo out of some hotel room and this guy had a piece of paper in his back pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And the piece of paper indicated it was just full of numbers and names and a lot of Spanish stuff. And the U.S. attorney asked me, two Milwaukee cops did the search warrant. The U.S. attorney's office asked me to take a look at this paper and see if I could make anything out of it. I can't remember the numbers, but at the time, H-A-F-C-E-N, do you know what that means?
No.
H-A-C-E-N. Anyhow, at the time, one of the figures was 50,500. And then over here was Juan, Manuel, Joey, Jim, this and that. And they would have plus or minus this, plus or minus that. Well, by the time I got done with all three of the papers, I determined with absolute confidence that the guy who was holding the papers had brought up and delivered 6 kilos of cocaine to Milwaukee. No question. So judge accepted the testimony, sentenced the guy to a god-awful amount of time. It went to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. It was one of the first drug note cases, I think, at least in the Seventh Circuit, where the Seventh Circuit closely reviewed it and agreed with me, but sent it back for a hearing. So we had to have another hearing about it. I did the same thing, et cetera. It goes back to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit affirmed everything. I said, yeah. Now, this makes sense. It is 6.5 kilos. It wasn't 6.5 kilos from a deal he did in New York. Dope peddlers, according to our expert, don't carry drug notes for weeks and weeks at a time. et cetera, et cetera. So that's, I did a lot of that, yeah.
And it wasn't just once. I mean, you did, I think in the book it says you did over 50 expert witness testimonies.
Yeah, I was somewhere around there. I was hitting the witness stand over a period of 10 or 15 years, maybe once a month.
Wow.
For either DEA or for a couple occasions, ATF, IRS. I worked real closely with IRS just to explain stuff because they do garbage pickups and they come up with all this, these great notes, like you were talking about earlier, with the names 10Z, $1,200.
Yep.
Well,
yep.
Yeah, it didn't take an expert to figure that out, but it took an expert to explain it to a guy that was qualified by the judge to be able to explain his opinion to the jury.
Absolutely. That the dumpster diving thing is not a glorious occupation to have, but it's amazing the information you get out of people's trash.
Yeah. It's just wonderful.
Not something you want to do on a regular basis, but you know what? When you're the new guy, you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's for sure.
Now, I also read in your book there about there was a cartel-related case that came to Milwaukee. I mean, this is a time when all the cartels are working in L.A. and New York City and South Florida, but the cartel hit Milwaukee, huh?
I'm trying to think.
The chapter's titled, I think, The First Cartel Case.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So we get a call from Fort Lauderdale. And it's this tip of the spear ring a bell. I think that was the name of the...
I don't remember reading that, but...
Okay, but anyhow, here's what happened. So prior to what I'm about to talk about, if we saw 20, 30, 40 pounds of pot, yeah, it was a lot of pot. Well, all of a sudden, one of Frank White from Fort Lauderdale, one of his guys called us up, and he says, there's supposed to be a big load of pot getting driven and delivered to Joe Shit the Rag Man at this phone number. So we run the phone number, we get an address, run out to the farm. It's a farm in Salem, Wisconsin, and it just looks right. You know, it smells right, it looks right. So we set up surveillance on it, and myself and my partner at that time, there was a abandoned, I think it was a VW bus or something. I don't know, it was a pickup truck parked just off the curtilage. And my partner and
Fair game.
Yeah, my partner and I fell on our bellies with our radio to and under. We get underneath the pickup truck, and we got a perfect eyeball on the front door. And we're not there for 15, 20 minutes, and all of a sudden, the doors open up, and the guys are walking out of the house with bales of pot, and they're throwing them into the truck. At the same time this is happening, I was close enough to the curtilage where I'm laying where I could get a good look, but I'm also laying in a position where I can't do a lot of moving. And one of the guys comes out to take a leak right on the tire that's hiding me. So I look at Charlie, my partner. I said, Charlie, this is bad. I don't know if they pay us enough for this. So he loaded up the van. The van takes off. We could tell there were still people in the house. Mm-hmm. We radio out. We said, they just loaded the van up with a lot of pot. You need to take it off, and when you take that off, we'll secure the house, get a warrant for the house, and boot the door down. So the truck full of pot takes off, do a vehicle stop. I don't know, it's three, four people in the truck, and I think everybody was armed, or two of the three people were armed. They radio back to us. They said, secure the place. We got dope, and we'll get a warrant. So we secured the place with a little bit of convincing because they didn't want to come out. There was two or three of them in there. But we secured it and went in and got 400 pounds of pot. Now, this is, bear in mind, like 78, 77, something like that. They get 400 pounds of pot. They had 600 pounds of pot in the truck, so that was a total of 1,000 pounds, which at that time was unheard of, and now nobody cares about.
Yeah.
But that was the first big pot load or coke load that we saw in Wisconsin. And we didn't know it at the time, but that was the first of many to come.
And those big loads of weed are just a pain in the butt to process as evidence, aren't they?
Horrible.
It's a lot of fun when you seize it, but the work that comes along afterwards is just...
Can I
it's
tell you a good
breaking? It's mind blowing.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contract. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Can I tell you a good story?
Sure.
So I'm dealing with a guy off of one of these college things, and he delivers a half a pound of Coke to me, which back at that was like in 74, 75, and he's driving a brand new Cadillac. So we pop him. We couldn't obviously buy the Coke, but we popped him, and I volunteered to drive the Cadillac to my house, and then we bring it down the next morning to the marshals. So what I was going to do, I was going to clean it out before we gave it to the marshals because it was full of all kinds of stuff. So I popped the trunk, and there's a great big blanket laying in the bottom of the trunk. I take the blanket, fold it up, take it over into my tomato patch, and I just shake all the residual stuff on my tomato patch.
Boy,
you know what happens next spring, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So we take the Cadillac down and give it to the marshals. Next spring, all of a sudden, my tomato plant are turned into a pot farm.
Yeah. DEA's it goes rogue.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure.
You know, when I was a city cop, I started in 75, and I think in 77 or 78, we moved into a new police station. And it was a combination of city hall, police, fire, everything. Really nice, modern at the time. And around the building, they had these huge planters, and they put bushes in there and trees just to decorate it up a little bit. The locals would come around, and you know, every spring you'd walk out there, and you'd see a marijuana plant start to grow up in one of the planters there. It was always funny.
Screwing with you.
Hello. Now, there's a guy that we mentioned in episode 1 yesterday. He recognized himself as the White Prince of Happiness and Peace. Who is that guy?
The White Prince of Peace and Happiness, yeah. Mel Chamblee.
Oh, Mel's a legend with the DEA.
He is a legend.
He was, how big was 6'4", 6'5"?
Oh, he was 6'6".
6'6".
300 at his biggest. Yeah, he was a monster.
Big.
Yeah.
Big man.
Yeah.
And the thing about Mel is he told you what he believed, whether you wanted to hear it or not.
No problem.
He spoke his mind, which I appreciated. I ran into Mel when I was a new GS, I think, in Atlanta. So this would have been in the late 90s. And he was a GS also at the time. I think he'd already done his time in Chicago and come down. And what the hell do I know about being a GS other than you know what I've seen my GSs do and he kind of gave me some instructions about what's important and what's not important, you know?
Yeah.
Which is, even though you've been a cop a long time, when a seasoned guy like that comes up and takes the time to tell you things, and he had an unbelievably great sense of humor, he'd come in a room and things could be tense and you're discussing whatever the topic is. And when you left, you had tears rolling down your cheeks from laughing at Mel. Just didn't care.
Mel and I worked a lot undercover together. And I would only ask him to help me if it was about him making cocaine because he self-taught himself how to make cocaine, or if it was going to be kind of scary and I needed somebody bigger than a freaking mountain to come in with me and fend off the bad guys.
Yep. He had the look. He had the physical appearance.
And he had a smile. He passed away. He married my sister after we did a dope deal, fell in love with her. They got married. But he had a smile I could see so many times. One time, I'm standing on if you're looking at a motorcycle with the front wheel up front here, I'm standing on the left side. He's standing on the right side. He's got a biker who's digging into a saddlebag, pulling out half a pound of Coke or a pound of Coke. And he's behind the biker. He pulls the gun out. He puts it right up to the biker's head with his eyes. He tells me, move a little bit over this way in case there's a lot of splatter. didn't want to ruin my leather coat. So I back around, and then Mel says, in typical DEA, I'll make it kinder, but he said, don't move or I'll blow your effing brains out all yeah. over the parking lot and this and that. But at that time, and I've seen it a half a dozen times or a dozen times, he had a smile which was both affectionate and threatening. You'd have to see it. But it would be like, it's this affectionate smile to me, like we're done with this deal. But Marty, the same, you'll see something different from this face because I'll kill you. And he was serious.
A little mischievous there, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
And not to get too far into Mel's career, God rest his soul, but he was the agent that put the tracking devices on the 55-gallon barrels of ether that were going to the cocaine labs in the jungles of Colombia.
He was.
You know, if most people would know anything about cocaine, know about Tranquilandia. And that was, I think that's probably the largest cocaine lab seizures ever. It certainly was at that time. And Mel kind of orchestrated that
because
he figured out how to track these chemicals. That was unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it's something like 10 yeah. labs were seized. I think it was 30,000 kilos.
It was
just a number, unbelievable case.
Did I go on for a second about that? Real quick.
Absolutely, man.
Okay. So Miami was so busy during this time period that Mel and I would coordinate our trips as to be in sync with each other so we could get together afterwards and go to High Life or go to Chuck's or go to wherever. So I'm meeting two Colombians down in an airport hotel. And I go, as soon as I walk in, I see a reporter from the Chicago Tribune, a crime reporter that had covered us on something, and I had met him. But when our eyes met, I said, oh, God, it's O'Brien. I said, just leave me alone. He could tell by the look on my face. Don't talk. So I'm meeting with these two Colombians. It's going to happen. Go to the bathroom. I'm going to the bathroom, and all of a sudden, this huge monster of a man stands next to me. And, Willie, what the hell are you doing down here? I said, no, I'm negotiating with a couple of Colombians. What are you doing down here? He said, I'm doing the same thing. He says, I'm negotiating with some Colombians. That was the people where he ultimately sold the 55-gallon drums of ether to. So he was stopping. And, yeah. And then a couple of weeks later, he calls me up. And, of course, the secretary says, it's the White Prince of Peace and Happiness calling for you. I said, good. He said, hey, do you ever get any dope off those guys you were talking to? I said, yeah, I got a couple kilos. That's all I can get. I said, how about you? He said, I got 10 labs, 30,000 kilos of cocaine, 14 airplanes, 80 or 90 people. I said, oh, that's a teletype I read. Yeah, that's a teletype.
Yeah. Right? Wow. Wow. I mean, before we leave Mel, I want to touch on one thing because this is our culture that I want to talk about just for a second. He was in Las Vegas when he passed, right? And you were in, where were you at that time?
New Orleans, I think.
And you weren't in a position where you and your wife could get out there to be with him. But what'd you do?
Well, my sister called me up and said, quote unquote, he's gone. Mm-hmm. And I said, where'd he go? And she said, no. She said, Billy, you don't understand. Mel's dead. Oh, my God. So it took a while to compose myself. And then we started thinking, because she's out there with Mel and his son, Jeff, at a wrestling meet. And it took a while to compose myself to get a game plan together, because you got to figure out what to do. So what we decided on doing was Mel's family would come out first to be with my sister and Mel. And my wife and I would go down to their place in Texas when my sister got there when she was by herself. But in the meantime, one of my instant thoughts was, and this was like the coolest thing, I said, I'm going to call the Las Vegas office. I need some help. And I know they'll give it to me. I just knew. I didn't know anybody in Vegas, or I didn't think I knew anybody in Vegas. I called Las Vegas office and I said, can I speak to Mike? I'll leave his last name out of it because I haven't talked to him about this. But yeah. I said, could I speak to the ASAP? That's what it was. And they said, he's in a staff meeting. And I said, you don't understand. I need to speak to the ASAC. My name is so-and-so. An agent just died in the backyard, and his name is so-and-so. Could you get the ASAC on the phone? Well, the meeting ended abruptly. Mike got on the phone. He's the guy that Mel and I used to work with in Chicago.
Yeah.
He says, what do you need? I said, well, my sister's sitting down at the bar drinking heavily because Mel just died. Of course, the ASAC was, he was upset too.
Mm-hmm.
In a matter of minutes, he said, okay, you got me in my office for as long as you need us. He said, I'm heading out there now. I'll stay with her until somebody else is able to pick up the point. And that's exactly what he did. He went out there, and I think he spent a day and a night with her until some other family arrived. And and we hadn't talked to Mike in, I'd say, 10 years. But that's...
Doesn't matter.
It's family.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's... When I read that in your book, it gave me chill bumps again here to listen to you tell the story, because that's what we do. It's a brotherhood and sisterhood. The law enforcement community... Regular listeners hear me talk about this all the time. It's just because you retire, you know, what I say is just because we retire doesn't mean that our oath's expired. And you've got that in your blood. That's about the only thing we know how to do is be cops. And when a brother's in need, you respond.
It's almost like a natural reflex. You just have to. Yeah.
Because you know, when they need help, that you're going to be there to help them.
Yeah.
I love it. It's just, that's one of the things I miss so much. So much being active, but yeah, this age thing just gets you.
There's a lot to be said about that. It's you can't explain it. I know military guys have the same connection.
Yeah.
We've got the same connection. We've got it's an unspoken connection that just works.
Yeah. It does. When I first got promoted to SES and moved to Washington, they moved me from operations to intel. I told the administrator back then, I'm like, I think you made a mistake here, because the words Murphy and intelligence don't go in the same sentence. But at the office, I only had one agent, and then everything else was analysts and contractors and some military personnel. Well, I had a gunny sergeant from the Marine Corps there. His mom and dad were on a cruise. They stopped in the Bahamas. His mom got violently ill. They had to put her in a hospital. Of course, the ship doesn't wait on you. They left. And he said, I'm going to need some time to figure out how I'm going to get my mom taken care of. And I said, okay, give me the name of the hospital. And he did. I said, give me your mom's name. I got all the pertinent information. I called the office down there, and my old carpool buddy, when I was in special operations, was one of the GSs down there. Called him and said, hey man, this is what's going on. Can you get your, what we call them, country attaches back then, I think's what we called them. And got him on the phone, explained everything. And I said, we got cars heading over to the hospital right now. We will be with her until we figure out how to get her home. And here's this tough guy, gunny sergeant, Marine, that just, I loved him to death. He was just a can-do kind of guy. But the fact that I would take the time to help him out, he was shocked to start with. But then you're part of the team. You're part of the team. That's the way it goes. You're in the family now. And then years later, after I'd retired, Javier and I spoke at the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, up in Washington, and the gunny was in there. Of course, he wasn't a gun anymore. He had promoted on up, and he gave me the biggest hug, picked me up off of my feet. And just, you know, to this day, I'm sure he still remembers that. But that's just the way it is in this culture. We look out for each other.
Isn't that wonderful?
It is. It is. And I want to talk about one more thing before we get close to the end here. But there's a technique called a knock and talk. So who invented that, and what does it mean?
Well, there's speculation as to who invented it. I think I did, but anybody who wants to quibble, I'll concede. What happened was somewhere around 1988, a Milwaukee police detective by the name of Oscar Perez comes over to DEA. He says, hey, I'd like to work with you guys. And he's young, aggressive, very smart. Him and I sit down, and we're trading stories. And he gave me a list, a big list of traffickers. And I had a list of traffickers who were potential people that we're going to look at and stuff like that. And by the time we got done talking, I'm thinking to myself, Oscar, you and I are going to die before we can treat these fellas properly.
Yeah.
So I said, why don't we go out? And I don't know who said the word, but I said, why don't we go out and introduce ourselves to these assholes and see what shakes out? So we go out, and for a period of 6 months to a year, we're going out introducing ourselves to all these dope peddlers, which is totally contrary to the way you conduct a narcotic investigation, because you want to keep it on a down low. And Oscar and I are just out there introducing ourselves. And during the introductions, we're finding that, number one, they're letting us into the house. And number two, one of us has got roving eyes while the other one's talking, and he sees a pile of 30 grand over here or half a pound over here. We started grabbing dope and grabbing money and did a lot of good stuff, including we got one good witness who we rolled him, and Oscar ended up with like $1 million in cash and 44 pounds of cocaine. So that's the introduction phase of it. Well, then I get involved in a gang wiretap, which takes a while. But then I get a sergeant from the Oak Creek Police Department. We call him Sharky. And he comes over to DEA Milwaukee and says, what can I do? What can we do? And stuff like that. I said, you know, Shark, I was wiped out after this trial. I said, let's go introduce ourselves to everybody you know and everybody I know and see what shakes out of it. So we go specifically on Monday mornings for two reasons. Reason number one is because when the guys would bring the dope up from Chicago, they would typically come up on a weekend, get drunk, and go home Monday.
Mm-hmm.
So Shark and I go, and we start knocking on doors, and we just, every door we knocked on, we walked out with dope. Dope or money, or dope and money.
Mm-hmm.
One specific, really unusual one was, we're going down, I think it was the 11th Street, and we're going to this one house of these traffickers that we knew were going to knock on our doors. But on the way to park the car, we both look, and we see there's a car parked on the east side of the street, and it's bumper to bumper with cars on the north and the south. And I'm thinking, we're both thinking, this is wrong. You know, you just don't do that. There's something going on here. So we parked the car. And again, this was not, as it turns out, it's not associated with the guy that we were going to talk to. We get out. I look in the back seat, and sure as shit, there was a brown paper bag full of money in plain view. And it's sitting there. So I said, quite frankly, between you and me, I said, instead of going to the track, let's stick with this and see if we can develop anything. So we set up on it. 10 minutes later, a guy comes from across the street, goes to stick his keys in the car. Sharky and I jump him, and it starts saying, is this your car? You know, we're the police. Is this your car? He said, no, it's not my car. Are those your keys? Yeah. Let's see if they fit this car. Oh, they do fit this car.
How about that?
How about that? Isn't that amazing? Now, at the same time, Sharky's talking to him about what's in the car and how he lied to us and stuff like that. I go to the back of the car. There's a north wind blowing. 11th Street is a north-south street. And I go to the back of the car, and more or less it's a joke. I'm sniffing around the edges of the trunk, seeing if I smell anything, I guess. But sure as shit, I smell marijuana. I mean, it was a strong smell of marijuana.
Yeah.
So I told Shark, okay, this car is ours. He's ours. Let's take him. We had, I think it was a kilo of coke, a pistol, and like 40 grand in the back seat. And in the trunk, in the compartment, was like 150 pounds of dope. Then we get the guy's name. This all occurs over a period of several hours because, of course, he doesn't understand English. And we finally get his real name and his real date of birth, run it through NCIC. He turns out to be a fairly high-ranking guy out of El Paso. He had federal warrants for the bum out of El Paso. But that was typical of our Monday mornings, where we would just go out and sniff stuff out.
Yeah, well, and I think I read where you weren't real fond of those Monday morning staff meetings, were you?
I tried to avoid that. Avoid that conversation. But yeah, that was part of the reason.
I love this. And I'm so sorry we're running out of time. There's a couple things I want to mention before we finish up that when you retired in, was it 2000?
January 1st.
January 1st. I mean, I looked in, and this is listed in your book, the numerous awards that you were recognized for throughout your career, for all the undercover, for all the investigations you did, for the ideas that you came up with, concepts, new ways of doing things to try to keep up with the dopers. The list is very long, but the one thing I think that impressed me the most was in September 22nd, 1995, as you were leaving Milwaukee to go to New Orleans. What happened that day?
The U.S. Attorney's Office invited myself and Gene out to a lunch, like a goodbye lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting there. There's probably six assistants and myself and Gene, and we're having a really nice lunch and stuff like that. And the mayor of Milwaukee, who I had met before, I did a search warrant on his block, and he came out and brought us a bunch of beer, thanking us for getting rid of the vermin, you know, on the street. But anyhow, yeah. The mayor of Milwaukee walks up to the table, and he goes, hi, he knew a bunch of the U.S. attorneys. And he said, good to see you, Bill and Gene. And I said, well, I couldn't believe that he would remember our names. But anyhow, he holds out this plaque. And he gives a spiel, I guess, every day to somebody. But he said, I'd just like you to know that the city of Milwaukee, blah, 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 loves you for being such a wonderful person. And we're going to name this day for you henceforth. And he shook my hand, and I got a little cheery. I said, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Just having a good time here.
So they designated a Bill Hare Day.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
That's outstanding. Wow. You know what? That shows that you made a mark. You left your mark on that community. You did everything you could to improve the community. And it's, quite honestly, it's like sticking your finger in a dike when the dam's ready to burst. But good for you, brother.
Well, thank you. I don't deserve it. But
don't say that. Yes, you do. I like to say that.
Look at who I'm talking to.
Well, you're talking to another old guy. That's it. But, you know, when you choose to serve your life, to serve your fellow man, you choose a career that serves others, there's no higher calling, in my opinion. I know you're being humble, as most all of us are, or we try to be anyway. Some of us can't quite help ourselves, and, you know.
Yeah, every once in a while it gets away from you, doesn't it?
Yeah. Sometimes we drink that Kool-Aid a little bit too much. But as I mentioned here yesterday on episode one, Bill's book is now out. It's called The Gambit, A DEA Agent's Undercover Odyssey. Let me get it up where you can see that. You can order that on Amazon. You can get it in Kindle. You can get it in paperback, hardcover. I got a PDF file. You can't get that.
There you go.
But that was so I could read it before we did the interview today. It's on Amazon for our regular listeners. You just go on Amazon, put in The Gambit, A DEA Agent's Undercover Odyssey. It'll pop right up. Or you can go to the Game of Crimes website, gameofcrimespodcast.com, and there'll be a link on our book page that will take you straight to Amazon where you can order Bill's book. Highly recommend it if you're interested in what DEA guys do. It's we just barely scratched the surface on the things that Bill was involved with. We didn't get into what he was doing down in New Orleans. So highly recommend you take a look at that book. It's out now, available. And again, that's The Gambit, A DEA Agent's Undercover Odyssey. If you're interested on social media, you can find Bill on Facebook and on Instagram at William Hare, H-E-H-R, William Hare. Okay, so go over, start following him, show him some love there. I mentioned to Bill this morning about a website, and I think his son did too. So we may team up against him and see if we can get him a website up and running for his book. Bill, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show here, giving us your time today, especially the fact that we don't really know each other. But that's what we love about our culture, is we don't have to know each other personally.
No, we don't.
Start part of the same brotherhood. And to your lovely wife, Jean, thank her for her service. She was a DEA agent also, who I think Bill was probably a dirty old man and hit on her as soon as she came in the office there in Milwaukee. But
there you go.
It worked out for you.
Well, I thank you, Murph. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you. I hope we get to talk again.
Yeah, I hope we get to meet in person someday, brother.
Okay.
So, listeners, thank you again for coming over to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all. And you know what that game is. It's the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next week. Well, hey, guys, that wraps up this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I hope y'all enjoyed the show and the guests. And if you did, feel free to spread the word. I want to thank you for taking the time to see and hear some of the best true crime content you can find anywhere. Believe me, I understand none of this would be possible without your support. In case you didn't know, Game of Crimes is now on YouTube. Just type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the YouTube search bar, hit that subscribe and like buttons, and feel free to leave a comment. And you can also email your comments to gameofcrimespodcast gamecrimespodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. There you'll find all our episodes, books written by our guests, and more. And for even more content, go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. There you'll find several bonus episodes each month, and you can get early audio access to each week's interviews before they drop on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can even subscribe for free and hear the first 5 minutes of each episode to help you decide if you want to spend some of your hard-earned cash to hear more. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. To all our guests here on Game of Crimes, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show, believe me. Thank you for your service to your communities, your countries, and for taking the time to tell us about your adventurous lives. May God bless and protect all the men and women in law enforcement, our military, and all of our first responders. That goes for all of our listeners as well. Thank you for your support. And just one last thought here. You know, it's okay for us to have different ideas and different opinions, but it doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends. Thanks again for joining me to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next week.